Saving money on your next project now at Menards. Menards is the leading supplier of quality roof and floor trusses. Choose from our large selection of residential and post-frame trusses or design custom trusses specifically for your project. Get started on your building project today, in-store or on Menards.com. Plus, view our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. On True Crime Today, the latest on three major cases gripping the nation. First, Brian Koberger's defense claims evidence in the University of Idaho murders was mishandled, despite prosecutors presenting detailed forensic findings. Next, Rex Heuermann's legal fight to suppress DNA evidence allegedly linking him to the Gilgo Beach killings. And finally, in the Karen Reed case, her defense highlights phone data and injuries resembling dog bites, pointing to a potential alternative explanation in the alleged murder. Plus, an in-depth conversation with psychotherapist Siobhan Scott about the latest chapter in the curious case of Natalia Grace.
This is True Crime Today. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
I'm Tony Bruschi. Welcome to True Crime Today. It starts with a knife sheath, a single piece of evidence holding a world of implications. But in the latest twist to the Brian Koberger case, the defense is doing everything in its power to ensure the jury never lays eyes on it. Now, this is how it works. It's a good defense, not necessarily a good defense for a jury to hear, but if they succeed in getting this piece of evidence removed, well, that's a game changer. It's not just the sheath that disappears from view. It's potentially the prosecution's linchpin, and the foundation of the case basically crumbles. Or does it? We're looking at one of the most scrutinized legal battles in recent times. Four young lives ending here in that quiet town of Moscow, Idaho. It sends shockwaves across the nation. And this was 3 years ago now. Everyone now watching this with a microscope. The man charged with the brutal murder stands at the center of a legal hurricane. His defense team firing on all cylinders, or as I've been saying, throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. And the latest now, a barrage of motions aimed squarely at gutting the state's evidence. Again, this is what attorneys do. It's their job. And Ann Taylor's doing it. Now, what she'll succeed in is what's going to be closely watched over the next several months. Among the defense's arsenal now is that full frontal attack on investigative genetic genealogy. IGG is what it's commonly referred to in shorthand. This isn't your run-of-the-mill DNA testing. It's high-tech sleuthing. It maps out family trees, narrow suspects in ways that were until recently reserved for cold case files. And in Koberger's case, the defense claims IgG overstepped its bounds. It's arguing that it violated the Fourth Amendment's shield against unreasonable searches and seizures. And this is where it's kind of up in the air. Was it unreasonable to use IgG when they're thinking, hey, this could potentially be the man that killed four college students? Many people will say, no, that's reasonable. The Camp Koberger will say, unreasonable. What's right? That's for the court to decide. You see, the knife sheath that was found beneath one of the victims was the first domino in this cornucopia of chaos. A trace of male DNA on the sheath led investigators down a digital rabbit hole of ancestry websites. And that's where things get a bit murky. It starts there. The defense insists that everything stemming from that sheath, search warrants, surveillance, and even trash collected from Koberger's parents' home was obtained through improper means. Their argument, no IgG, no case. No case for you. The stakes couldn't be higher in this. Now, the odds that they're going to get it dismissed, crazier things have happened. If the defense succeeds in suppressing this evidence, the prosecution's narrative could unravel. No DNA, no digital footprint, and the jury's perception of the case, well, that kind of hangs in the balance. But the IgG is not the only target, nor should it be if you're Ann Taylor. The defense is also taking aim at a slew of search warrants, alleging they lacked the specificity required by law. Koberger's apartment, his car, and his family home. Each location was combed through, and now the defense wants all of it thrown out. All of it. And then there's the no-knock raid that led to Koberger's arrest. His attorneys are calling it unnecessary and overreaching, painting a picture of law enforcement bending the rules to secure their man. Well, if it is their man and they've been searching and searching and this turns out it's probably him, I think they probably used the right amount of force, but he's innocent till proven guilty, right? Prosecutors, for their part, aren't budging. They maintain that IGG was merely an investigative tool, not the basis for the warrants. They argue that the police followed the law and the evidence is rock solid and that Koberger's rights were not trampled. The battle lines are drawn here now, and the January 23rd hearing before Judge Stephen Hippler, that's going to be a showdown. Meanwhile, the victims' families in all of this, Kaylee Gonzalez, Madison Mogan, Zana Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin, their parents, they wait for justice. Their names have become a rallying cry, a reminder of the lives shattered on that November night, and the legal chess game continues to unfold. One more question looms. Will the evidence that could convict Koberger even make it to trial? This is where we say, at the beginning of a trial, before trial, that's the most important part, because most of the battles are either won or lost in motions hearings, which we're hearing right now. Now, because Ann Koberger says this shouldn't be in the case, this is done wrong, or look, that's her job, it doesn't necessarily mean there's a scintilla of truth to it, but they got to see what happens. They got to see what they can make stick out there for the defense of their client. The defense's motions, 10 in total, two still sealed, signal a strategy as aggressive as it is calculated. They've even filed for a Franks hearing, which is bizarre in this case, but again, throw it at the wall and see what sticks, to prove that investigators misled the court to obtain search warrants. And if granted, it could open Pandora's box of legal challenges for the prosecution. And let's not forget the timeline. Koberger's trial is slated for August of 25. The wheels of justice are turning. They turn slow. Jury selection begins in July, and if these motions succeed, the prosecution could be left scrambling to rebuild their case. Or we're going to see the trial pushed out further. That would be devastating to those families. This isn't just a legal battle. It's a high test of modern investigative methods. A clash of constitutional rights versus cutting-edge crime solving. Or something like that. And as the courtroom drama intensifies, one thing is clear. Every piece of evidence, every motion, every ruling could tip the scales of justice. So where does this lead us? With more questions than answers, did investigators overreach in their pursuit of Koberger? It should be something, for the sake of justice, that is looked at. If a question is raised, it should be answered, not just dismissed. Will the knife sheath's DNA and the technology that uncovered it hold up under legal scrutiny? And perhaps most importantly, will the families of four young victims find the justice they've been waiting for? Moving on now to Rex Huerman in a move that can only be described as audacious. Rex Huerman's defense team is now attempting to throw out what could be the most damning evidence against him. DNA, another case where they're doing it. See, this is what defense attorneys do. Yes, DNA, the forensic gold standard, the fingerprint of the modern age, the tool that has locked away more criminals than you can count. It's suddenly questionable now. Well, it always is questionable when it's the other side that's having it used against them. According to Huerman's attorneys, the method used to analyze hair found on the victims is unreliable and lacks the general acceptance of the scientific community. Again, this is Huerman's attorney speak. Doesn't mean fact. Let's pause for a moment here. We're talking about Estera Forensics. It's a lab that specializes in extracting DNA from degraded samples, often solving decades-old cold cases with their advanced methods. These aren't amateurs playing with a chemistry set in the garage. This is cutting-edge science. It's validated by countless successful prosecutions, but apparently Uriman's team feels that because this technique wasn't available when DNA first became a thing, it's not trustworthy. We can't trust science or anything moving forward. We sit at the beginning precipice of DNA technology and don't move forward from there. Kind of like DNA Amish or something. Their strategy hinges on a motion to exclude expert testimony related to nuclear DNA results. In layman's terms, they're trying to silence the scientists who can explain exactly how this evidence ties Huberman to the crime scene. Why? Well, because why would you want to connect your client to the crime scene? Hair, tiny fragment of biological material, it places him right there with the victims. And let's be real, when you're accused of being a serial killer, the last thing you want is irrefutable proof that you were at the scene of the crime, or your family. There were hairs of multiple family members on these burlap sacks. Not saying the family was there, I don't think they were, but when you got a hoarder house and you have DNA from multiple people in that same house showing up in multiple crime scenes, I'm guessing it may have come from your home. This challenge has triggered the need for a Fry hearing now. For those not familiar, a Fry hearing is where the court decides if a particular scientific method is generally accepted by experts in the field. It's like a courtroom vetting process, if you will, for science. Yes, science. Now, ask yourself, why would the defense fight so hard to exclude this evidence if they weren't worried about its power to convict? District Attorney Ray Tierney isn't buying any of it. He says, if we weren't confident in the efficacy and admissibility of that evidence, we wouldn't have used it. In translation, we know what we're doing and we're prepared to prove it in court. The defense, they're going to do what they're going to do. Their argument, the technique lacks acceptance. It's laughable. It's laughable that you think this is usable. Well, it's quite laughable that you think it's not, actually. When you consider that it's been a game changer in the field of forensic science. Again, this isn't a fringe method. I have to stress that. Just because someone says it is doesn't mean it is. It's been used for countless years. Cold cases. Ways to exonerate the innocent, and yes, convict the guilty, too. The scientific community may debate nuances, as they do with everything, but the results speak for themselves. DNA doesn't lie. But you know who does? People. So what's at stake here? Pretty much everything. This DNA evidence links Huberman to not only one, not two, but multiple victims in the Gilgo Beach murders. If the court excludes it, the prosecution's case could take a serious hit. Without that biological connection, the narrative shifts and doubt creeps in. That's exactly what the defense is counting on. But let's not forget, DNA is just one piece of the puzzle. Huberman's life is under a microscope. His movements, his purchases, his online activity, all of it paints a chilling portrait of a man who, by all appearances, led a double life. On one side, a family man, an architect, a pillar of his community. I don't know if pillar is the right word or more boulder. On the other, a cold, calculating predator hunting his victims and leaving behind just enough evidence to be caught. The irony is palpable. The defense is essentially arguing that the science is too advanced to be reliable. I mean, think about that for a second. We're living in an age where we can sequence the entire genome in hours, where genetic genealogy is literally reuniting families and solving crimes every day. And it's solving cases that have haunted communities for decades. And yet, Huberman's team wants you or the potential jurors out there to believe that this same science, it's flawed when it comes to Rex. In the end, it is certainly more than just a legal battle. It's a fight for truth and accountability. The victims and their families deserve justice, and the community deserves to know that the man accused of these heinous acts will face every shred of evidence against him. DNA has been a silent witness, waiting patiently for its day in court. Let's hope the judge sees through the smoke and mirrors and allows the science to speak. Because here's the thing. If you're innocent, you welcome the evidence. You don't fight to keep it out. And that's what makes the defense of this so absurd. It's a desperate attempt to muddy the waters, to create doubt where there should be none. But DNA doesn't waver, and neither should justice. And I'm sure Rex's digital devices won't waver either. So as we watch this trial unfold, we're going to keep our focus where it belongs, on the evidence, on the victims, and on the truth. Rex Heuermann's objections may be loud, but you know what speaks louder? DNA. Moving on now to Karen Reed. A seismic shift in the Karen Reed case may be on the horizon, one that could redefine the narrative. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court's ruling on the admissibility of Cellbrite data, delivered just days ago, it sent shockwaves now through a lot of the legal teams involved here. Why? Because this decision breathes fresh life into the cornerstone of Reed's defense. That's a key prosecution witness's digital footprint that may hold more than just innocuous internet searches. It might just crack the entire case wide open. Picture this. It's a cold January morning in 2022. The snow, it's blanketing Canton, Massachusetts. Boston police officer John O'Keefe's lifeless body is lying outside home of fellow officer Brian Elbert. From outside, the prosecution painted a grim picture. Karen Reed, O'Keefe's girlfriend, drunkenly backed her SUV into him, maybe even in rage, maybe even with intent, leaving him to freeze to death. But Reed's defense claims something far more sinister, a police cover-up, where she, Karen Reed, is a scapegoat. At the heart of this tangled legal web is a single chilling detail. A Google search allegedly made by Jennifer McCabe, a key witness, according to defense expert Richard Green. This is defense expert Richard Green. McCabe typed, "How's long to die in cold," at 2:27 a.m., hours before O'Keefe's body was even discovered. Green's analysis, based on data extracted from McCabe's phone using Cellbrite software, suggests an intentional deletion of those records. Okay? This is what their expert is saying. Here's a twist. The prosecution's own expert, Ian Whiffen, claims there's no trace of those searches, at least not at 2:27 a.m. Whiffen's examination using Cellbrite's latest software update shifts the search to a much later time, around 6:24 a.m., after O'Keefe's body was found. And to muddy the waters just a little bit more, Cellbrite itself recently updated its software, removing certain timestamp features that Green relied upon. So this is literally the company that makes the software saying, okay, I get your guy over here who doesn't work for us, who has nothing to do with this software. Here's how we interpreted it. But if you come over here, here's the instructions on how you really, truly interpret it, because this isn't really made for human consumption over here. This is just kind of how our system works. Let's go take a look at it over here on how we analyze it from the inside as the engineers and such. Okay, this is what this translates to. The company is literally telling you, here's the rules of the game. I know you think it looks good over here. That'd be really exciting if it did. But when you actually translate it correctly, you're wrong. And that's it. We have no stake in the game. We're not pro Karen Reed or against John O'Keefe or whatever. We're just, here's the data. Here's how it works. Here's the instruction manual. Read it. This is how it works. This is how you translate it. And then you'll have your answer. Well, Karen Reed's camp doesn't like those answers, so they're just going to stick with what they think is right and completely ignore the instructions given by the company. It's a high-stake game of a digital cat-and-mouse chase, with both sides angling to discredit the other's experts. The prosecution has filed a motion to bar Green's testimony entirely now, labeling his methods factually flawed and a risk to jury clarity. But if Green's findings hold water, it could prove a damning blow to the prosecution's timeline. It could. And that's why facts are so important here. And then there's Dr. Marie Russell, the defense's dog bite specialist, who's been a lightning rod of controversy. She testified that O'Keefe's injuries align more with a dog attack than a vehicular collision, changing her story from the trial this summer. The prosecution, however, spent hours grilling her qualifications, questioning whether she's even equipped to make such determinations. To them, Russell's testimony amounts to a speculative fiction. To the defense, she's a critical piece of the puzzle, one that suggests O'Keefe met his end inside Elbert's house, not under the wheels of Reed's SUV. Keep in mind, this expert, 30 years in the ER, But again, not studying dog bites, not studying anything really to do with that. Just going, oh, I can, yeah, that's what that looks like. I was a kid once. You were a kid once. I can usually kind of tell what road rash looks like, but I'm not an expert in it. When I looked at O'Keefe's arm in that picture, I don't know. I could say I've wiped out of my bike a time or two or tripped a time or two as a child and had an arm that kind of looked like that. But why don't we, I don't know, take a look at the dog. Still alive, right? Sure is. You can look at the dog. Maybe you can measure the canines. Maybe we can see if this actually does match up or has a way of matching up in some way, shape, or form to the marks on O'Keefe's arm with the dog. They even did a plaster casting of the dog's mouth. I'm sure the dog liked that. When presented with that information, the defense's expert saying, oh, that's nice. Well, we have it. Would you like to use that? Would that be something that's going to be helpful to you? I'm not so sure. I'm paraphrasing. What kind of expert doesn't want more evidence to try and base their decision on when presented with it? And why didn't she look at it to begin with? It was there the whole time. The legal wrangling doesn't stop there. Two accident reconstruction experts, Andrew Reichsler and Daniel Wolf, have also come under fire. Their analysis during Reed's first trial supported the theory that O'Keefe's injuries were inconsistent with being struck by a vehicle. Now, the prosecution wants them silenced, filing motions to exclude their testimonies in the retrial. There's so much confusion here. Amid these courtroom battles, a darker undertone looms. Specter of corruption. Reed's defense team alleges a conspiracy where key evidence was tampered with to ensure her conviction. It's a bold claim, but one that has gained traction, especially given the inconsistencies surrounding digital evidence and testimony. And as if the stakes weren't high enough, Boston Magazine's Gretchen Voss has become an unexpected player. Her off-the-record interview notes with Reed are now the subject of a heated legal battle, with Voss refusing to hand them over, citing journalistic integrity. Meanwhile, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court's recent ruling further complicates matters by upholding the admissibility of Cellbrite data presented by non-experts in a totally separate case. Is this a good idea? The court has essentially greenlit similar evidence in Reed's trial. This decision could sway the judge's impending ruling on whether Richard Green's testimony, and by extension, the timeline it supports, will be allowed. And what of Reed herself? What about Miss Reed? Facing second-degree murder charges, she's become a polarizing figure. Her supporters argue she's a victim of a deeply flawed investigation. Her detractors see her as a reckless woman whose actions cost a man his life. But the thing is clear, the stakes for this retrial, now set for April, couldn't be higher. Let's not forget a community that's been ripped apart as well by a single person. And as the clock ticks towards the hearing on January 31st, where the admissibility of Green's testimony will be debated, one question lingers. Will the truth finally emerge, or will it be buried beneath a mountain of conflicting evidence and legal maneuvering? We'll soon find out as the drama of Karen Reed continues on. And now we shift our attention to a case that we've seen come back to life in recent days thanks to investigation discovery. It's the curious case of Natalia Grace. Final chapter. Joining me to discuss, psychotherapist and author Siobhan Scott. We've both watched this, Siobhan. I'm just going to start right there with you and give you the floor. What were some of the initial reactions you had while watching this new chapter in the Natalie Grace saga?
Poor young woman has just been bounced around, rejected. The original people, the Barnetts, who had her, that was bizarre. They were bizarre. Mm-hmm. This putting her at 8 years old into an apartment by herself and expecting her to function and projecting that she's a psychopath and malevolent. I mean, that was weird as heck. Mm-hmm. Could it get worse? Well, it didn't get much better with the Manns. You know, this religious cult-like belief system. You know, when I was a kid, I spent a bit of time in Pentecostal churches. These people are nuts, okay? Another clinical term, wackadoodle.
Yes.
I mean, they're this stuff about the devil being everywhere and literally casting demons out of people in the middle of their church services. I called that one last time as this is not a good situation for her. I don't think this is going to end well. And it's you know, traumatic, it's horrifying, and it just makes me sick that, you know, now she's, I believe, what, 21 or 22? She actually is now.
Yeah.
And the fact that she has never been in a home with normal people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just sad.
People oftentimes wonder, well, why is she acting like this? Why is she not trusting? Why is she manipulating everybody? Because she's never been able to trust anyone ever. Now, are some of the things that she's doing very, you know, disturbing? Yes, but that's what happens when you've been abused your entire life. You repeat the cycle of being disturbing because that's all you know. So it comes out in different ways. And that truly is what happened here. When you look at the Barnetts, I don't even know what was going on there. It seems Christine Barnett really had some sort of image or idea of what she wanted to be and when she wasn't. You know, it was all out. We never heard from Christine. She's in Canada, and it's not ever commented on that. Then you have the husband who just seems to be like, I'll go along with whatever anybody wants, and also wants to perpetually be a victim as well. But yet the child, the son of the Barnetts too, who did testify or on camera saying, yeah, some of this crazy stuff happened, which is not to, I guess, say she didn't do those things. Because I think she probably did in a lot of ways, but it's more so trying to understand why she did those things. So you went from that extreme of abuse to a different extreme of abuse with the religiosity and all the accusations against the man's. As of our recording right now, I tried to do some research on them last night. Not a whole lot to find other than an Instagram page. He has taken all of his religious recordings off the internet. But what we have seen is, they raise kids for money, basically. I know they'll say it's not, it's this church, because he's a bishop. I mean, he invented his own position in his own church.
Exactly.
He wasn't, like, declared a bishop by a real church. He made a church and goes, I'm a bishop. I guess it could also be Jesus, too, if you wanted to make your own church.
Sure
I'm
could.
Jesus.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. But he really wanted to get that point across in the doc. When people would address him, it's like, it's bishop to you. But there was audio in there, a background audio. They didn't know it was a hot mic moment a few times where we're going to get the belt out and things like that. So they're clearly, if there's not yet, I hope to God CPS is looking at this family because they're not healthy and this is not safe and this is not normal, but it's all under the guise of religion. All that being said, Natalia goes into that world. And she seemed to really have a very hard time breaking out of that one. Even more than the Barnetts. But she was there for quite a while, I believe almost 10 years under that sort of thinking. Eventually, Natalia is talking to another family, a family who originally wanted to adopt her, the DePauls, and they help her escape. She's not a child anymore. They literally picked her up outside of the church and took her to their home in a rescue effort, if you will. The shocking thing was, Natalia is saying how horrible that house is, goes to the DePauls and is calling the man's right away, telling them, you know, I love you, here's where I am, I'm safe. And the first question out of the mouth of the man's, the wife in that, was, do I still get your money? Am I still the recipient of your social security checks? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, it's inconsistent what comes out of Natalia's mouth from time to time. But as you said, she's never had consistency. She's not a stupid young woman. Clearly, when she speaks, she's got a good vocabulary. She speaks well, but she's very confused on what reality is. And therefore, you know, she can hold different realities that conflict all at the same time, which is the mans are abusive, but I love the mans, you know, and that's common with kids from abusive family backgrounds. They're mixed up, and it takes them a good 10 years after they get out of that kind of situation to sort out what reality really is and what they were living with and what was brainwashing. And, you know, I can't imagine what it's like to be told as a child, oh yeah, the devil is speaking out of your mouth. You know, so she heard things like that. She believed things like that at the time. And she's very mixed up, very confused, and I don't think anyone should take all of it too seriously as far as judging her, because any of us, if we were raised in these bizarre families, we would be mixed up.
Yeah, without a doubt. What would you say to Antoine Mann? We had heard so many phone calls where he was talking with the DePauls. And anytime there was confrontation about them taking Natalia's money or really anything that could be viewed negatively towards them and legitimately, not just an opinion, like yeah. You've been taking her money and you refuse to pay the taxes on it. You're going to throw that at her. They would immediately go to, it's the devil talking. The devil speaks lies. And it's like, no, someone's just pointing out the facts here. How would you address that, knowing what you know about people and your education in this with culty-type individuals like this and that belief system where they just get so dug in the second they hear something different, it's the devil. How do you get through to that?
You really can't. This is intransigent. And the thing that's so unfortunate is that at some point, people with this kind of mindset, which I think we can say it's a crazy mindset, mm-hmm. Why have they been approved to take foster kids? Yeah. You know, again, it speaks so poorly of our system, the foster system, that there's, and I think it's desperation. They're so desperate to have people who are willing to take kids in. So they don't look that closely. It's like, you know, is there a record of molestation going on? Is there food in the house? Is there shelter? Will the kid have a bed here? And that's about all that they care about.
Yeah.
You know, somewhere to dump these poor foster kids. And it's just awful because, you know, if I had any power in the system, I would say these people should not be raising foster kids. It's not good for them.
And the bar is very low on all this where, okay, do they have shelter? Do they have food? I mean, without really taking into consideration the conditions of those things sometimes and going, is this really a better option than where mm-hmm. they're currently at? Because I think mm-hmm. in a lot of cases, it is not. And this does go on in our system. And I don't know why it does other than, like you said, they're desperate. They need people.
They're desperate.
And mm-hmm. and I think there's probably a group, a handful of really good people in this world yes. that do take in kids en masse and have a good place for them. And they do their best. And it's for the right reason. I will say from life, and just living life and meeting all sorts of people, anyone I've ever met that has taken in massive amounts of children is not doing it necessarily for the love of children. They're doing it because they can't get the job at Walmart or Wendy's or really anything else.
Anything.
So what they're going to do, they're going to raise children, which is always a great idea if you don't qualify for basic minimum wage work. Let's mm-hmm. raise kids. And the system says, great. You're a warm body. You can raise these kids. What could possibly go wrong? And I think that might need to be re-examined a bit because there's way too much of that that goes on in our system that we all pretend doesn't, or we're completely unaware that it
is. Unaware. And I think when people are aware, they don't know what to do about it. So they throw their hands up and there doesn't seem to be any oversight, you know, of the agencies, at least not enough. And, you know, the other thing about the man's, she needs to have a plan for independence. And why weren't they saving some of her money forward so that she would have the funds, mm-hmm. you know, maybe they need to take a certain percentage out for her support, but certainly there should have been oversight of what is happening with that money and what is the plan for her to eventually go out and be able to live independently or at least in a group home with peers, something better than she's going to be with them forever in this situation. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, seems criminal to me.
It seems there's very, very little oversight other than you get parents or the previous guardians to sign off the kid. And then you get the money. That's all there is. Yeah. It's not like, well, let's check this and make sure this is all legit. And you're actually, yeah. I mean, there's nothing in this system to make sure that the money is spent correctly for children when they're receiving it. They just doesn't mm-hmm. happen. Is this an America problem? Is this how, I mean, obviously we have a very broken system. Are there other systems out there? Because we're always saying this is broken, this is horrible, we need it fixed. Is there any other examples in other countries where they got this down a little bit better? Obviously, a child not having a parent, that's never going to be a great situation, but is there examples of it being done better?
That is a wonderful question, and I can't say I have ever investigated it, but yeah, we should be looking at Canada. We should be looking at Europe. You know, what do they do in Germany and Spain? You know, I know that they don't have the homeless situation mm-hmm. that we have here in other countries. So it may be, again, that America, we're such a big country, right? 340 mm-hmm. million people. That's a lot of kids to manage in systems. That's a lot of homeless people to try to take care of and figure out a plan. And when it comes to social problems, we're not the best in the world.
No, we're good at creating them, though. We're good at going, here's what we should do because we're going to base it on a religious principle or what my mommy or my daddy told me, and then we're going to get it done and it's going to happen. And once you're alive, good luck. We don't care. Mm-hmm. you slut. You had a child out of wedlock and now you want help? Well, we forced you to have the kid, but now you want help or we're going to care for? No, we don't do that. We just wanted to make sure it came to the world. It's baffling. And I'm not going political either way. I'm just saying, look, if you're going to give a shit that far, you should give a shit for the rest of the kid's life then too.
Very true.
And making sure they're in a good place so they can develop and not just repeat the same cycles over and over and over and over.
Yeah, because having functional people in the country benefits all of us, mm-hmm. right? You don't have people back in the system for the rest of their lives. You don't have them in jail. You don't have the additional social problems that we have because of it.
Yeah, we're like I said, we're very good at creating the problems and very, very bad at solving the problems we create. Seems to be getting worse and worse. This is a prime example of it. I don't certainly have the answers to it. I know you don't either. But it's just glaring every time we hear a story like this.
That's our report for today. Thanks for listening. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you get podcasts or videos. I'm Tony Bruschi. Good night.
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
So they said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.